Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. I have a couple of reasons that I wanted to do this class. And the first one is because we did in the youth group, we had a lot of kids that were asking questions regarding purpose and meaning and all that. And some of them were even questioning the existence of God. And so I wanted to take a stab at proving to them that God exists. And from my perspective, what came out of that was that 20 minutes is not long enough to prove that God exists. So hopefully a few sessions can do that. Another reason is because I want people, myself included, to be equipped to be able to give an account for why they believe what they believe. Not just, I believe because I was told. Atheists use that argument a lot, that we believe some book just because we're told to believe it. And that's not the case. So, if it's okay, we're just going to start. So some people say that there was nothing before the universe began. Science says that there could not ever be nothing because something cannot come from nothing. So if there ever was nothing, there could never be something, because there would still be nothing. Does that make sense? If you ever have nothing, there's no way to get something. I agree with science. There always has been something. It's just what that something is that's the question. So science says that the universe is growing. Everybody's heard that. It's expanding at a very fast rate. Science admits that this universe is not eternal, could not have always been. So I agree with science. So this is why they came up with the Big Bang Theory and cosmic evolution. It is widely accepted in the world that the universe is 13 to 14 billion years old. The Earth is supposedly 4.6 or 8 billion years old. These statements I do not agree with. I don't believe that they're science at all. See, everybody believes in a creator, be it a god or the universe itself, or just energy that caused the Big Bang. There is something that transcends this material realm. There is something that was not created when all of this began. There's an apologist, Greg Boyd. He says, whatever there was that is the cause of what is must be quite different than what is, because what is cannot always have been. The theist's claim is that there is something that never came to be, simply because it always was. There's another apologist named J. Wallace Warner. He says, the Christian definition of God is the uncreated creator of the universe. We cannot see God. We cannot explain what he is. We don't know what he is or what he's made up of. So are we crazy to believe in a God? Well, we cannot see gravity. Nobody's ever seen it. Science can't explain what it is. We don't know what it is or what it's made up of. Are we crazy to believe in gravity? No. Science cannot explain energy, can't explain what it is. We can harness it, we can utilize it. You can mathematically predict it like gravity. But nobody knows what it is. There's the first law of thermodynamics says that gravity cannot be energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be converted. That kind of puts a damper on the Big Bang thing. So are we crazy to believe in energy with the lights on? Nobody knows what consciousness is. It cannot be observed. Science has a few theories, but not science has never come to a consensus as to what it is. They can't. So are we crazy to believe in consciousness? Nobody knows what information is. We can transfer it. Information is immaterial. What it rides on material. It's on this page. It's on cell phones. It's on computers. You can transfer it through radio waves, all kinds of different ways. But nobody knows what information actually is or where it's originated. So are we crazy to believe in information? Nobody knows what meaning is, what purpose is, what the mind is, and the list just goes on, guys. Are we crazy to believe in all these things? See, science is great for studying things, how things work, new discoveries, advancements. Science can answer a lot of questions. It can tell us how our bodies work, tell us what's good for them, can tell us what's bad for them, but it cannot tell you why you have one. Science can tell us all about nature, all about the earth, and much about the universe, but it cannot tell you why it is all here to begin with. Science is very good at answering the question how and often what, but it remains very lacking when it comes to answering the question why. It's widely said that a scientific explanation is very rarely a complete one. I need to read a couple of analogies for you guys out of a book. This is a guy named John Lennox. I don't usually vouch for a man, but this book is an incredible book. It's a short read. It's 120 pages. He's a scientist. He's a philosopher. He's a mathematician. He's a teacher at Oxford. He's very good at explaining things in ways that people can understand, making very complex things very simple. He says this. He says, the next thing we need to realize is that a scientific explanation of something is not necessarily the only rational explanation that is possible. There can be multiple explanations that are equally true at the same time. Suppose you ask the question, why is this water boiling? I may say that the heat energy from the gas flame is being conducted through the copper base of the kettle and is agitating the molecules of the water to such an extent that the water is boiling. Or I may say that the water is boiling because I would like a cup of tea. We see at once that both of these explanations are equally rational. They each make perfect sense. Of course, I lost my spot. But they are very different. The first is scientific, and the second is personal, involving my intentions, my will, and my desire. What is also obvious is that the two explanations do not conflict or even compete with each other. They complement each other perfectly. That's very true. This second analogy, it's also in this book, but this book is a condensed version of a lot of stuff that he wrote. I just like this version better. So he says, let us imagine that my Aunt Matilda has baked a beautiful cake, and we take it along to be analyzed by a group of the world's top scientists. I, as a master of ceremonies, ask them for an explanation of the cake, and they go to work. The nutrition scientists will tell us about the number of calories in the cake and its nutritional effect. The biochemists will inform us about the structure of the proteins, fats, and etc. The chemist about the elements involved and their bonding. The physicist will be able to analyze the cake in terms of fundamental particles. and the mathematicians will no doubt be able to offer us a set of eloquent equations to describe the behavior of those particles. Did you get that? Now that these experts, each in terms of his or her own scientific discipline, have given us an exhaustive description of the cake, can we say that the cake is completely explained? We have certainly been given a description of how the cake was made and how its various constituent elements relate to each other. But suppose I now ask the assembled group of experts a final question. You probably know where we're going. Why was the cake made? The grin on Aunt Matilda's face shows that she knows the answer, for she made the cake, and she made it for a purpose. But all the nutrition scientists, biochemists, chemists, physicists, and mathematicians in the world will not be able to answer this question. And it is no way an insult to their disciplines to state their incapacity to do so. Their disciplines, which can cope with the questions about nature, the nature and the structure of the cake, that is answering the how question, cannot answer the why question. In fact, the only way we shall ever get the answer is if Aunt Matilda reveals it to us. But if she does not disclose the answer to us, the plain fact is that no amount of scientific analysis will ever enlighten us. It's incredibly true. There's a Jewish rabbi, his name is Jonathan Sacks. He says, science takes things apart to see how they work, but religion puts things together to see what they mean. You can replace the word religion with God or with faith or whatever, but we're saying the same thing. Questions like, why are we here? Does God exist? Meaning in life, simple questions that a child asks, cannot and will not ever be answered by science. Asking science questions like these is like asking me to prove to you that I taste licorice right now. How do you do that? How does one scientifically prove to you another person's interior conscious state? You can't. Science is no good here, but science can at least point us to the most logical answers. Science has found out how incredibly complex all of life is, from the universe to the smallest subatomic particles. Everything is so complex, it's often said in the creation science arena that one cell is more complex than a space shuttle or than the most complex supercomputer that man has ever made. One cell is more complex than anything made by man, and yet trillions of them work together to keep you together. Some say quadrillions of them work together to keep you. Think of all the systems in the body, the muscular systems, the digestive, the skeletal, the nervous, the reproductive. They're so complex. There's no way they could have happened by chance and random processes. And to say so would be in no way, shape, or form a scientific statement. You just look at the DNA. It's called DNA code, even by atheist scientists. The genetic code, the human genode. It is the instructions for building proteins, which are the building blocks of the body. The thing about codes, even atheists know, codes are written by a code writer, by a designer, by an intelligent designer. This is what true science points to. This designer, the theists call God. But we're not going to get into that this week. We're going to get into science next week. Sorry. Most of science's pioneers were theists. They believed in God. They don't advertise this much, but it's true. It's very true. Science, also known as natural sciences, used to be called natural philosophy. actually the University of Oxford in England, which is the second oldest university in existence, still uses this terminology when referring to a degree. Now it's more commonly known as physics, but they still use natural philosophy. Science, modern day science, was birthed out of philosophy. I don't know if you've ever heard of Plato, probably, but he was a philosopher. He's credited with saying, he's from way from before Jesus' time, he's credited with saying that light is the shadow of God. He was a theist. Aristotle, I think he was a student of Plato's. He said, God has many names, though he is only one being. And he also said, God and nature create nothing that does not fulfill a purpose. Aristotle was a theist. Some people, I guess I'm not totally aware if they were polytheist or monotheist, but they did believe in a high God, not just many gods. There's a man named Galileo. Have you heard of him? He's a little bit more recent. He was the first to see through a telescope, to use a telescope. He's the one that found or discovered that Saturn has rings. He's the one that discovered that the moon has mountains and craters and stuff like that, like the Earth does. He says, I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has bestowed, who has endowed on us with a sense of reason and intellect has intended us to forego their use. He was a philosopher and a scientist. Pascal, has anybody heard of Pascal? I can't pronounce his first name. Pascal's wager. Yeah. He was, I think he's the one that came up with the idea for hydraulics. He was a scientist. He was a philosopher. He says, if you wager on God's existence and you are wrong, you lose nothing. But if you wager against him, you lose indefinitely. Which is very much true. But it's interesting because atheists use this a lot and they bash the Christian mindset and they think that everybody believes because of that. That concept, that's not what he meant, I don't believe, when he originally said it. I don't agree that that is the reason we should believe in God. We should be convinced. So I understand what they're saying when they say it. But still, Pascal believed in God. Sir Isaac Newton, anybody heard of him? He said, he who thinks half-heartedly will not believe in God. But he who really thinks has to believe in God. Anybody know who Ben Franklin is? I sure hope so. He said, well, first of all, I think did he invent the lightning rod? I think so. He was a big inventor too. He said, I have lived a long time, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proof I see of this truth, that God governs the affairs of man. How about Thomas Edison? You probably heard of this. He said, he's the one that did the light bulb, I think. He said, I do not believe in the God of the theologians, but that there is a supreme intelligence, I do not doubt that. Which we can work with that. Alexander Graham Bell, he was the inventor of the telephone. He said, God has strewn our paths with wonders, and we certainly should not go through life with our eyes shut. Another theist. Nikola Tesla, heard that name? He's a lot more recent. He said, the gift of mental power comes from God, the divine being, and if we concentrate our minds on that truth, we become in tune with this great power. How about Albert Einstein? Einstein boldly says that science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. I like that one. It's very true. The cool thing about this John Lennox is he was a student of a guy named C.S. Lewis. You heard that name? Yeah. He made an impact. He was actually one of C.S. Lewis's last students at Cambridge before he died. Lennox says this. He says, C.S. Lewis sums it up well when he says, "Men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver." It was theistic philosophers that birthed science, modern day science. It's just that's conveniently left out in a lot of history. Psalms 111 says, "Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in him." We all know a lot of the laws of nature. The law of gravity tells us that the apple is going to fall from the tree. The law of mathematics tells us that 2 + 2 = 4. So this is one thing that atheists have a problem with, is miracles, because they say that they violate the laws of all these laws of nature, therefore they are impossible. I got one more thing I got to read on this note, because he does a very good job at debunking that. There's no way I could repeat it. It's a big argument with atheists, miracles. I apologize because this one is 2 pages long. But I just don't know how else to do it. Okay. He says, "You cannot recognize something as abnormal if you do not know what is normal. This was actually well appreciated long ago, indeed at the time of the New Testament writings. Interestingly, the historian Luke, who was a doctor trained in the medical science of his day, raises this very matter. When in his account of the rise of Christianity, Luke informs us that the first opposition to the Christian message of the resurrection of Jesus came from atheists." Came not from atheists, I totally read that wrong. "But from the high priests of Judaism. They were highly religious men of the party of the Sadducees. They believed in God, they said their prayers, and conducted the services in the temple. But that did not mean that the first time that they heard the claim that Jesus had risen from the dead, that they would believe it. For they did not. For they had embraced a worldview that denied the possibility of bodily resurrection of anyone at all, let alone this Jesus. So to suppose that Christianity was born in a pre-scientific, credulous, and ignorant world is simply false to the facts. The ancient world knew the law of nature as well as we do. The dead bodies do not get up out of their graves. Christianity won its way by the sheer weight of evidence that one man had actually done this. The second objection to miracles is that now we know that there are laws of nature and can describe them. Miracles are simply impossible. This is called Hume's famous objection. However, I don't think this objection holds water." Lennox says, "Let me illustrate. Supposing this week I put $10 in a drawer of my desk. The following week I put in a $20. And then the week after, another $10 is added, and the drawer is closed and locked. The laws of arithmetic allow me to predict that the next time I open my drawer, I shall find $40. But suppose the next time I open the drawer, I find just a $10 bill. What shall I conclude? That the laws of arithmetic have been broken? Certainly not. I might more reasonably conclude that some thief has broken not the laws of arithmetic, but the laws of the land, and has stolen $30 out of my drawer. One thing it would be ludicrous to claim is that the existence of the laws of arithmetic make it impossible to believe in the existence of such a thief or the possibility of his intervention. Quite the reverse is true. It is the normal workings of those very laws that cause us to believe in the existence of the thief and the activity in my house. This analogy also reminds us that the scientific use of the word law is not the same as the legal use, where we often think of a law as constraining someone's actions. There is no sense in which the law of arithmetic can constrain the thief in our story. Newton's law of gravitation tells me that if I drop an apple, it will fall towards the center of the earth. But that law does not prevent someone from intervening and catching the apple as it falls. In other words, the law predicts what will happen provided there is no change in the conditions under which the experiment is conducted. Thus, from the theistic perspective, the laws of nature predict what is bound to happen if God does not intervene. It is no act of theft, of course, if the Creator intervenes in his own creation. To argue that the laws of nature make it impossible for us to believe in the existence of God and the likelihood of his intervention in the universe is plainly false. It would be like claiming that that an understanding of the laws of a jet engine would make it impossible to believe that the designer of such an engine could or would intervene and remove the fan. Of course not. He could intervene. Moreover, his intervention would not destroy those laws. The very same laws that explain why the engine worked with the fan in place would now explain why it does not work with the fan removed. David Hume was therefore incorrect to assert that miracles violate the laws of nature. What we could say is that it is the law of nature that human beings do not rise again from the dead by some natural mechanism. But Christians do not claim that Christ rose from the dead by such a mechanism. This point is of a vital importance for the whole discussion. Christians claim that Jesus rose from the dead by a supernatural power. So by themselves, the laws of nature cannot rule out the possibility. When a miracle takes place, it is the very laws of nature that alert us to the fact that it was a miracle. That's his argument against the whole miracle thing. They cannot violate the laws of nature. The Creator can intervene in his own creation. The science will tell us that they discovered these laws, but they cannot tell us where they came from or why they even are here to begin with. But simple logic, rationality, and reason points us to the idea that there is a lawgiver, like C.S. Lewis said. This lawgiver, this intelligent designer, this thing that always has been and is the cause of what currently is, the theists call God. This lawgiver has a reason for his laws. This designer has a reason for his design. This thing that always has been has a reason for wanting everything that now is. This thing answers all of the why questions. Therefore, I cannot believe that the theist is crazy for believing in a God. I believe there's way too much evidence for one. The theist does not operate in blind faith like the atheists think. God would not expect us to. God is very much a God of evidence. As Lennox also points out, that in the book of John, John even says that these things are written so that you might believe. He brings up the fact that Luke was into historical sciences. He did the process of writing his gospel. He did all the things that a historical scientist would do, went around and interviewed, got all the evidence before he wrote. The whole Bible is written for evidence. Evidence for God. But unfortunately, that's the thing, the Bible is not good enough as proof for most atheists. Probably all. But lucky for us, the founder of the scientific method has been in use for hundreds of years, 300-400 years. The scientific method, Sir Francis Bacon, have you heard that name? He taught that God has written two books, the Bible and the Book of Creation, which is probably my favorite book. I say that carefully. I don't want anybody to take it the wrong way, but I love my Bible. I can't tell you how many times I've read it. I've listened to it on audio a dozen, 15 times probably. I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to read it till the day that I die. I'm going to learn from it till the end. There's no going back for me. So I don't want it to sound wrong, but I love even more, I love finding God outside of this book. I love finding God out there. I love finding his fingerprints on the earth. I love finding his footprints in the world. He's everywhere. In nature, like Francis Bacon admits, the founder of the scientific method, it's crazy. He was a theist. I love finding God out there. God predates this book. I understand the concept that this is the Word. This is the Word in material form. I get that, but the Word, say, in the beginning was the Word. The Word predates this physical book. The Word will outlast this physical book. It'll always be around. Just, if this thing's destroyed, that doesn't mean that the Word is destroyed. It's the whole concept of the information. You can burn this book, but does that mean that the information is gone? The information is immaterial. Nobody even knows what it is or where it came from. I love finding God outside of this book. And that's what we're going to do for the next few weeks, if that's okay. So once again, Isaac Newton, he said, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants, mainly referring to his science, his discoveries. If he has seen further, if he's discovered something, it's only because of the people that have gone before him, because he picked up where they left off. That's the only reason, and it's not just pertaining to science, but I believe it also pertains to faith. There are giants of faith, and we all know a bunch of them. Joshua stood on the shoulders, so to speak, of Moses, picked up where he left off. The apostles stood on the shoulders of Jesus. They picked up where he left off. Ever since then, it's been the same process. Reasons for this class again. I guess I don't know this guy. I had to look him up because I didn't know who said this quote, but you guys maybe you've heard this. His name is William Arthur Ward. He's the one that says the mediocre teacher tells, the good teacher explains, the superior teacher demonstrates, the great teacher, inspires. If these classes, and I'm sure anybody that ever teaches anything or preaches, that's their desire. If one person is inspired, because if one person is inspired to go seek God out in the world, the classes are totally more than worth it. Today was kind of philosophical. Today was not necessarily intended to prove that God exists, but more to prove to you that you're not crazy for believing in a God. You're not alone if you're a believer, not in this moment or in the light of all of history. If you think about it right now, there's 2.2 or 3 billion Christians on the planet. There's 1.8 or something like that Muslims on the planet, monotheists, believe in one God. That's half the population of the globe. That's just that believes in one God. If you add up all the ones that believe in more than one, that's probably 2/3, 3/4 of the world believes in something greater than themselves. So you're not alone for believing in a God, though you may feel like it here in what the rest of the world would call the West, just because of all the stuff that's pushed. Today it was kind of to prove to you that you believe in things you cannot see and do not even know what they are every minute of every day of your life. Every time you take a step, you trust gravity, yet you don't even know what it is. Every time you turn on your phone, you're trusting that there is energy in it, yet you don't even know where it is. You've never even seen it. You don't know what it is. You've only seen its effects. You've only seen what it can do, what an immaterial thing can do in a material world. Sounds funny, huh? You're trusting every time that you look at your phone that there's going to be information on it, and you don't even know what that is or where it came from. Why is it so easy for people to dismiss an immaterial God being able to impact a material world and not dismiss all these other things? Today was to prove to you that God and science go hand in hand. They do not compete with each other at all. Rather, they complement each other almost perfectly. Laws of nature included. To prove to you that miracles do not violate the laws of nature at all. To encourage people to stand on the shoulders of giants that have gone before them in regards to science, the material world, and in regards to faith. I want to do one more quote and one more cool fact, and then I'm going to be done. So John Lennox, this professor at Oxford, this modern-day philosopher, he says, "My reason for not being an atheist is not because I'm a Christian. My reason for not being an atheist is because I can do science." C.S. Lewis, I don't know if people know, I didn't know it for a long time because he's made such an impact. C.S. Lewis was an atheist the whole first half of his life. He didn't believe in God until he was 30. He died, I think, at 64. So in 34 years, he made an impact on the world. It's crazy to think about, but he blames the fact that he was an atheist for so long because of his false perceptions of science. Once he got his perceptions right, like you're talking about, then he couldn't deny the existence of God. He couldn't deny it. Science, real science, you cannot come to the conclusion that there is not a designer. You cannot. So there's an argument that atheism is not a material, a naturalist, a scientific thing. It's a religion. I agree with that very much. But for today, I want to be done. I wanted to leave, 10 minutes at the end, just in case anybody has any, wants to make any comments, any add-ons, or anybody wants to ask a question or anything. If not, we don't need to, we can just be done. But next week we're going to get into science.